Welcome to this meeting of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. Today is Tuesday, January 22nd, 2008, and it's good to be back with you all, members of the committee. Thank you all to members of the public as well for joining us today here in the Belts Room. We have Senator Davis, Senator Bundy, Senator Stevens, and Senator Hoffman, and myself, Senator Ellis. So thank you all for being with us today. We have a full calendar of legislation in this abbreviated session. We're going to be mindful of the schedule in this committee and give due deliberation to all the legislation before us and act expeditiously when required and carefully when required to complete the work of the committee in a timely fashion. So I appreciate your cooperation with that. The first order of business today is Senate Bill 120, which will not be before the committee today. We're still working on through the stakeholder process on some information from various interested parties. So I hope to have a committee substitute for us to consider here in the near future. But it's still a work in progress. The next item then that we will have before us today is Senate Bill 28, limiting overtime for registered nurses. Senator Betty Davis is the prime sponsor of this legislation. It was before us during the regular session last year. It has been in our committee's possession for the interim, and we have some more testimony to take today, first from Nancy Davis of the Alaska Nurses Association, and then from Rod Beatty of the Alaska Hospital Association by phone, and anyone else who signed up to testify. And there's a committee substitute before us as well. Members should have that in their packets. I'm going to ask Mr. Owen, the committee aide, to come before us to review the proposed committee substitute. I don't need a motion to adopt it. Our normal practice, if we'll all remember, is to hear about a proposed committee substitute and then to accept a motion at a later time. So we'll have the presentation on the committee substitute, take the testimony of the two main interested parties and others, and then consider the CS. Mr. Owen, if you could put yourself on the record and please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dana Owen. I am an aide to Senator Ellis, chairman of the committee. The changes to this bill are from the Hess committee version, which we had taken up last year, are four. The first one on page 2, on line 24, we have a subsection C that sets out exceptions to the limitations on overtime. A new paragraph 1 has been added, which now includes nurses at an occasional school event in these exceptions. This amendment was suggested by nurses who pointed out that they often accompany field trips that last longer than the normal workday. The second change is on page 4, line 25. A new section of statute, AS 1820-440, spells out an enforcement mechanism for the prohibition against retaliation set out in AS 1820-430. Under this section, the commissioner has 90 days to determine whether a facility has violated the statute. If the determination is yes, the commissioner must request that the Office of Attorney General represent the department and the complainant and seek all appropriate relief. The Department of Labor and Workforce Development suggested this amendment to us. The idea is to provide clear authority to the department to investigate and act on allegations of violations. The provision is similar to that for violations of occupational safety and health. The third change occurs on page 5, line 4. New language specifies that the report required by AS 1820-445 is to be submitted to the division responsible for enforcement. Earlier drafts sent the report to the research and analysis section of the department, and once again, the department requested this this amendment. And lastly, the effective dates have all been moved a year forward to recognize the year that we're in now.
Thank you, Mr. Owen. Are there any comments or questions at this stage for committee staff? If not, I'll give you all a moment to think about that. I had intended when we started the meeting to review the entire agenda for the folks who are in the audience. For the new people that have come in, Senate Bill 120 is still a work in progress. Unemployment insurance, so that was on the calendar, but it will not be considered yet today. It's not ready. Senate Bill 28, overtime for registered nurses, or limiting overtime, is the bill before us now, to be followed by Senate Bill 107 by Senator Davis by request, licensure for naturopaths. That bill has been before us, and there is a new committee substitute that we will consider. And then finally, we hope today to get to Senate Bill 147 by Senator French, a first hearing on his workers' compensation employer liability bill. So that's the game plan for today, for the folks who are with us. Okay, any other comments or questions about the proposed committee substitute? Mr. Owen, is it fair to say that these are clarifications and requests that came to us in this committee substitute to help improve the legislation came to us over the interim?
Yes, I'd say that's fair.
Okay. Okay, let's hold consideration of the CS to have the benefit of public testimony. The nurses and the hospital association have been before us before in the last regular session, but I think this would be a good reminder of the issues at hand. So first, Nancy Davis, if you could join us, please. If you just state your name and affiliation again for the record, and please make your comments on the bill.
Thank you, Senator Ellis. My name is Nancy Davis, and I am a registered nurse and have been so for 39 years. Today, I come to you as the Vice President of the Alaska Nurses Association to speak in favor of the committee substitute for Senate Bill 28. The Alaska Nurses Association represents, our membership is almost 1,000 nurses here in Alaska, and this is a bill that, an action that we heartily support for a number of reasons. It's a great step forward, I think, for Alaska to protect the health and safety of patients and nurses alike. Senate Bill 28, committee substitute, recognizes the impacts of fatigue on nurses who are the mainstay of round-the-clock patient care. There's been a lot of information, I think, provided to the committee in the past and in a packet that hopefully you currently have, but it's well known that excessive work hours for some occupations become a critical issue for safety. Excessive work hours for nurses is a very risky response to a staffing crisis. It puts patients at risk due to nursing staff errors that may be made due to fatigue. That's a shame in terms of patient care, but it's also a liability for everyone. It puts nurses at risk of injury due to excessive work hours and fatigue. That's a problem for a professional group that's already facing a professional shortage situation. It's also a liability for worker injury and worker compensation issues. I think it puts us all at risk for possibly further aggravating and deepening the nursing shortage that exists globally, not just in our own state, causing more nurses to leave the profession due to excessive work demands and unbearable work conditions. There are many other opportunities for nurses in the workforce, and we are having trouble keeping nurses in the workforce and encouraging people into the nursing workforce. So in summary, and to be brief, Senate Bill 28 helps prevent patients from suffering the consequences of nurses making errors due to fatigue. It helps to prevent nurses from suffering injury due to fatigue from working excessively long hours, and it really helps our state prepare for and respond to the nursing shortage due to nurses leaving the profession because of excessive work demands and working conditions. The action taken by Alaska is one investment in ensuring the health and safety for patients as well as the nursing workforce. And so, therefore, the Alaska Nurses Association heartily supports the committee substitute for Senate Bill 28.
Okay.
I'm happy to take any questions, and I believe also Tom Rankus, the executive director of our organization, is also online if there are specifics. There are a number of states who have passed similar legislation, and we find that that probably the difference of opinion comes down to viewpoint. When someone says it is not a problem and someone says it is a problem, it probably has a lot to do with the space from which you're looking at the same issue. Our membership feels that it is a problem in some organizations right now, and we'd like to see this kind of legislative protection so that in the future some administrator, maybe who there's an agency doing a great job right now with enlightened management and patient safety at the forefront of every decision they make. However, it's possible that in the future, as the nursing shortage deepens, that may not be the same approach, and we think this bill is a good protection for the public. Thank you.
Ms. Davis, thank you very much for your presentation. My staff has notified me that I misspoke. We took extensive public testimony on this bill during the regular session, and so today was invited testimony for a recapitulation of the main issues so that we could hopefully take action today on this legislation. So thank you for your presentation. We're going to have Rod Beatty come up next. I'm sorry. Questions for the presenter. Ms. Davis, if you could. Yeah. Senator Bundy, I apologize. Yeah. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I certainly don't want people to work overtime if they don't want to and if it endangers them and our patients. But you've spoken quite clearly several times to a nursing shortage. Is it possible that if this bill were to pass, would there be wards on staff because there just aren't nurses without overtime to cover those areas?
Through the chair. Senator Bundy, I think the nursing shortage can create shortages in many different ways, but we do know that putting a patient in an unsafe situation is not the solution to the staffing problem. Some organizations have elected to not keep open as many beds if they have not enough nurses to staff safely. There are management approaches to the nursing shortage. Certainly, having your organization be a place that carefully cares for both patients and nurses is one of the ways to keep nurses from leaving your organization. So the shortage is going to continue, but it won't get better if more people are leaving the profession. So we're hoping to keep more nurses in the profession. Nurses who've been nurses for 39 years may come back into the profession if we have viable working conditions for them. I don't know if that's an answer. It may create more shortage,
yes.
but overtime is not the answer to the staffing crisis.
Thank you.
Okay. Senator. Thank you, Senator Bundy. Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to follow up on that, Ms. Davis, you say that nurses are leaving the profession. Do you have any statistics on that or any evidence that is and people are leaving the profession because of overtime?
Well, that's the hardest part to try to. We have nurses who say, I can't do it. I can't do 12-hour shifts. I can't do certainly double shifts. I can't do double back, which is working one shift, being off one, coming back for another. And so they pick other employment. Clearly, the 24/7 patient situations are the most critical ones for which this makes a difference. And there are places where nurses can work day shifts only, like home care and out of institution places. So I think they are leaving the hospital. This is anecdotal. I wish I had statistics right at hand, but Tom Rankus, who is our executive director, may have that information. If you would like more detailed, nationally, this is considered a problem. It has been studied about, especially as the nursing workforce ages, it becomes more of a problem.
Mr. Rankus, do you have that those facts and figures at hand, or would you be able to provide that to the committee record in writing?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, the record Nancy speaks to is fairly anecdotal with regards to the senator's question specifically about mandatory overtime. We know the shortage will encompass millions of nurses in the future, and the issue at hand is the 14 states that have passed the mandatory overtime legislation and the hospitals that work toward garnering a better workforce through working conditions actually have zero to 3% open rate on the RN positions. The hospitals that continue to use the practice of mandatory overtime and mandatory call can have open positions up to the 10% to 20% ratio around the country. So while statistics are still being garnered with regard to mandatory overtime specifically, it has shown that the hospitals who essentially work toward a market perspective of providing a work environment that's conducive to employment have less of a shortage than hospitals who don't take action.
Mr. Rinkus, could you just state your full name and affiliation for the committee record, please?
Sure. Tom Rinkus, R-E-N-K-E-S, the Executive Director for the Alaska Nurses Association.
Thank you very much. Anything further for Ms. Davis? If not, thank you very much for being with us. Rod Beatty, you're there by phone. Rod?
I'm here. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Loud and clear. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for allowing me to speak by phone today to you. I have reviewed the amendments that I believe were put before you today. I appreciate Dana being able to get those to me so I can take a look at them. We've provided much testimony in the past on this bill on behalf of our membership, which is over 30 healthcare facilities in the state, basically every facility other than Samuel Simmons in Barrow. And I understood from Dana what you were looking for was basically a understanding as to whether Ashton's position is similar to what you had heard in the past. What I can report at this time is that we still cannot support Senate Bill 28. It has provisions in it which we think are really beyond that appropriate for the kind of data that is available in terms of what's happening specifically in Alaska. I've listened with interest to the testimony about overuse of mandatory overtime in other states and measures other states have taken to address that. I think in your packet you'll see that we've been monitoring mandatory overtime use here in Alaska for some time now. And the data that we've provided, which is hard data from our member facilities, is that mandatory overtime is not one of the tools they use to close the nursing shortage gap, but rather they use temporary nursing staff to do that in order to protect the interests of nurses and patients alike. Both are equally important to our members. In addition, facilities have been working hard to try to produce an adequate number of nurses for healthcare in Alaska. And one of the ways we've done that is to work with the University of Alaska Anchorage to increase the nursing student graduation rate from about 100 students a year 4 years ago to 200 a year. And the data is showing that 93% of those nurses are staying in the Alaska healthcare community, not leaving the state in order to practice. The other point I'd make is that we really don't believe that venturing down this road would be in the best interests of healthcare or in the interests of supporting facilities attempting to strike a reasonable working condition for a nurse, which is locally managed now, mostly through collective bargaining, where individual facilities sit down with the nursing community and arrive at something that they feel is reasonable for them and locally fits the lifestyle and availability of nurses in that particular community. That has served the state well. It has served nursing well. And we believe that that is the way we should continue to do that, absent any information that would suggest any facility in Alaska is actually misusing mandatory overtime. We're refreshing that information again after 2007 has passed to make sure that we can report back to you that mandatory overtime is not something that's being imposed on nursing personnel. And we'll have all the facilities reporting sometime in the next couple of weeks. We have some of that data already, but it isn't complete at this point. And again, it continues to show that our members are taking this very seriously and are not using mandatory overtime in any kind of inappropriate way. So in summary, we appreciate the committee's interest in healthcare and patient safety, and we echo those concerns. But we really don't believe that any evidence has been presented to the committee that would suggest that this is an area that requires any legislative attention at this time. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Mr. Beatty, thank you for being with us and for being succinct in the issues surrounding the bill. Did you have any comments about the proposed committee, the clarifications in the proposed committee substitute?
Specifically, Mr. Chairman, I don't. Most of those impact the department that's responsible for managing the reporting of this. We think the reporting requirement would be onerous to facilities to have to comply with, again, without any evidence that there's a problem there that needs to be reported on. But I guess I would leave it to the agency to speak to that.
Okay. Well, this was their suggestion, some of this clarifying language. So any questions or comments for Mr. Beattie? Senator Bundy.
Thank you. Good afternoon. You may have heard my question to the previous testifier about whether this passes, would it leave basically beds uncovered, wards uncovered? And from your testimony, I think I understand that you do not, or in Alaska, mandatory overtime is not being used. So indeed, if this passed, it's unlikely that there would be wards or beds, however it's categorized, left uncovered?
Senator, that would be my response. I think that's a fair characterization of what would happen. I guess I'd have to leave it to other facility representatives who may be on the line or testify later if they see it differently. But right now, there is still a continuing shortage. We're hearing from our members that the shortage is improving, not worsening. And so what that would hopefully show is that we're having to use fewer travelers or temporary nurses to fill the gap and not resort to mandatory overtime at any point. And what the record shows from both our facilities and their personnel staff, as well as from the Department of Labor, is that mandatory overtime has not been brought forth as a grievance by individual nurses, to our knowledge, any time in the last 10 years as an area of concern. So I think your statement is accurate, Senator.
Mr. Chairman, a follow-up?
Please.
Yeah, and thank you. And an additional question. In the packet that we received, I believe it's information from a national nursing organization, suggested that one of the solutions, of course, to mandatory overtime and, I guess, a nursing shortage was nearly a doubling of nurses' wages from some 44,000, I think, to 70-plus thousand. I think we're all concerned about the cost of health care. Is it safe to assume that if we were to follow their recommendations, it would have an impact on elevating the cost of health care?
Senator, I think that's through the chair, that's a very astute conclusion. The reality is right now, when we did this survey last year, showed that the starting wage was in the $23, $24 an hour range for a nurse. I presume that our new data will show that that's gone up some more. So let's say it's in the $25 an hour range, and that doesn't include any voluntary overtime or on-call pay. So you're talking about a starting wage in the $50,000 per year area currently for a new nurse.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bundy. Anything further for Mr. Beattie? Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Beattie, the last time we met, you had expressed some concerns about the bill, and one specific was about the complaint investigation. Does that ring a bell? Is that still an issue for you, and what does that mean?
Through the chair, Senator, I'm not recalling what my comments would have been at that time on that provision. The whole complaint investigation area is of concern if it's to be done, anytime somebody wants to file a complaint. And the kind of reporting that this particular bill requires is down to the individual nurse using overtime rather than an aggregate kind of report. So my concern might have been around the scope of the reporting and how broad and deep it is compared to just facility-wide reporting that is applicable in other states that have adopted this kind of an approach.
Well, thank you.
Senator Stevens takes good notes from past committee hearings and had that as an issue, so
we
appreciate that.
I can read it a year later.
Better than my handwriting, for sure. Okay, well, it appears it doesn't sound like there's any controversy or concern about the proposed committee substitute. It's clarifying language requested by the folks who will be most involved in this if this becomes law. So the chair will entertain a motion at this time to adopt the proposed committee substitute /V version for the bill at hand.
I would like to move that we pass this along to the next committee or
Well, we're just on the committee substitute.
We're to adopt that and pass it.
Okay. We'll have to take just the first half of that motion. So there is a motion before us to adopt the /V version committee substitute for the bill. Is there discussion of that motion? Is there objection to that motion? Hearing none, that is the version of the bill that's before us. So at this stage, This is the discussion stage for further consideration of the bill. I would note that the bill came from the HESC committee, hearing in the HESC committee, here to Labor and Commerce for about a year, and then the bill goes on to finance on the Senate side. I personally am persuaded that this is reasonable public policy. I've been concerned about the nursing shortage. I know that's the sponsor's concern in introducing the legislation. I believe this will help with it, and we're not plowing unplowed ground here. Other states have moved in this direction as well, and many of them report a positive effect. So for me personally, that's where I am on this legislation. And if it is to receive further consideration, it would need to move along through the process. But I appreciate hearing any other thoughts of the committee. Further discussion, Senator Bundy.
Yeah, this seems like a 51-49
close call.
Yeah, in that if mandatory overtime is not being used, it's not going to help Alaska much. But in other states where they've eliminated it, their turnover rate has been reduced. I think this may be a Band-Aid on a far bigger problem, but I wouldn't like to think that if this becomes law that our problems in the nursing field are over.
No, maybe an incremental change. Any further thoughts before I entertain a motion to move the bill on? I don't want to abbreviate any conversation that people want to have. If not, the chair will entertain a motion to move the bill on to the next committee of referral, which is Senate Finance. Senator Davis?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make a motion that we move the CS for Senate Bill 28 from Labor and Commerce to Finance.
Okay, that's the motion before us. Any further discussion?
With accompanying fiscal?
Yes, and it is attached.
That is why it's coming to you, Senator Hoffman. Senator Hoffman gets several chances on this bill. Is there any discussion of the motion? If not, thank you, Senator Davis. Is there any objection to the motion? Hearing none, the bill moves from committee. Thank you all very much for your interest in this bill. Okay, we turn next to Senate Bill 107 relating to naturopathy, licensure of naturopaths. This bill came to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee and moves, if it were to move, it goes to the HESC Committee and then on to Senate Finance. We have a resource person here, Emily Kane, from the naturopath. She's available for questions on this legislation. We do need somebody to come forward and help us remember this bill from last year. Okay, we're going to ask Mr. Owen to come back to the table. There is a proposed committee substitute on this bill as well. Give the committee members a chance to remember this bill from last year. And so, Mr. Owen, if you could just recapitulate briefly what we're doing or what the bill proposes to do here, and then the proposed CS.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Dana Owen. I'm staff to Senator Ellis. Excuse me. The bill proposes to establish a structure that would regulate naturopaths in the state of Alaska. Regulate an expanded scope of practice for naturopaths in the state of Alaska. I'd like to, as I did with the previous bill, I'd like to walk you through the changes from the original bill to the CS that you have in front of you. We've changed the title to reflect some of the changes, so I should note that in passing. The first major change you'll find on page 3, line 12. The previous bill had a fundamental part of the structure was that there were two bodies that would regulate the practice of naturopathy. One would be a formulary commission and one would be an advisory committee. This CS proposes to combine those two bodies into one. It's in Bill Section 5.
Mr. Owen, if I could interrupt there, that was a concern by the Division of Occupational Licensing from last year. From our old friend who's no longer there?
Yes, this is correct. He brought this to our attention and suggested that this would be one change.
Right.
The powers of both the committees under the original bill would be vested in this new single committee. Its name would change into the Alaska Naturopathic Council. Previously, we had the Alaska Naturopathic Formulary Council and the Naturopathic Advisory Committee. Now it would be the Alaska Naturopathic Council. The committee membership reflects this blending. There'll be three naturopaths. One of those would have to be outside the 3rd Judicial District. One would be a pharmacist, and one would be a public member who may be a physician. The single council retains all the powers and duties ascribed to each of the bodies in the previous bill. I should note about the public member. It was presented to me that physicians felt that they did not want to be forced into participating in the process. There's some concern on their part for liability, and we decided that the best way to solve this problem would be to have a public member who may be a physician if there is a physician who wishes to come forward. Section 8 of the bill.
And just for nuance there, we didn't decide anything. We're just proposing that for the committee's consideration.
Yes, right. Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
We decided to include that in the CS, I
yes.
should say. Section 8 of the original bill is deleted in the committee substitute. That section amended the duties of the state medical board to include appointing a member of the formulary council. The requirement for a physician or osteopath in the council has been dropped in the CS, as I just explained. So this section is no longer needed in the bill. Section 10 of the bill has transitional provisions. These have been rewritten to conform to the new requirement for a public member in place of a licensed medical doctor. So the changes all reflect the blending of the two bodies that we had in the previous bill.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Owen. Yeah. Senator Bundy?
Thank you. Has there been a change other than the medical doctor and the makeup or the numbers and the makeup of the commission or the council?
The Mr. numbers, Mr. Chairman, the numbers of the body that exists now in the CS are the same as had been proposed for the formulary council before. The advisory committee, I believe, was three members, but now that's been expanded as we've combined them.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I would just observe that I think on most other councils and commissions there is more public participation. In this case, the public member. There's only one, and it seems in other cases the public has greater representation and perhaps then more influence in when it comes to voting on issues. And I'm wondering if the committee ought to consider that number and whether it should be changed.
Okay. Other comments or questions for committee staff? If not, thank you, Mr. Owen. As I mentioned before, Emily Kane is available for any questions about this, but it's been a collaborative effort over the interim between committee staff, representatives from the naturopathic community, and the professional folks at occupational licensing. Okay. We'll invite Tom Obermeier, staff to Senator Davis, the sponsor of the bill, to come forward for a few brief comments. Mr. Obermeier, welcome.
Thank you, Tom Obermeier, staff to Senator Davis. This committee substitute follows the general direction of the original bill, but it has changed substantially, and I wanted to make sure the committee was aware of that. This bill, which came as a referral to Senator Davis, followed up on a bill that had been introduced in the 23rd legislature that was of the same subject matter, and at that time, there was to be medical doctors involved. They had considered a full board before the state, and of course the Alaska State Medical Association in both instances has rejected this bill, and I wanted to make sure you understood their reasons for it, and you should have in your notes from the prior bill their objections to minor surgery and to pharmaceutical use. The current version essentially waters down the controls that have been implemented in our initial bill, where we now have just one board that is supposed to be supervising everything. Discipline, continuing education, pharmacy, the selection of all Legend drugs by a pharmacist that's presumably appointed, and he's supposed to be responsible for the drugs that are to be used, IVs, and if you read some of the other details of the bill, these things have been pointed out and are of concern to the rest of the medical community. And I think from what I could observe from the State Medical Association's concern was that they're really concerned that this practice is being changed into what they would call primary care physicians, although you're not allowed as a naturopath to use the title physician in the title of your practice, or there's some question about using doctors, but of the four institutions that license these people for their own practice and they have a national exam, they do use the word, they give them certificates of naturopathic physicians and so forth. But the main concern is that there, in protection of the public, if they are to do these things, that there would be enough oversight in the state that the people supervising it would be able to control it and make sure that all of these procedures make sense. If you're asking, for example, for medical laboratory reports from the hospitals, which would occur under this bill, whether you're asking for x-rays or whatever other attention, that this be protected, that the public be protected, and these people be properly trained for all this. The one thing that the State Medical Association pointed out in their letter to this organization or this committee last year was that there had been a task force in the 23rd legislature that it did not fulfill the obligation of reporting to the state back concerning the comparison of the training of medical doctors, their continuing internships, and extensive hospital practice while they are in medical school compared to the primary care physicians that come out as MDs versus the naturopaths. So, in short, my only concern about the changes is that there's enough oversight worked into the process, since the physicians do not seem to want to have any part of it, that the public is adequately protected.
Mr. Obermeyer, do you have a comment about Senator Bundy's concern regarding the amount of public participation on this new board?
Yes, there is a very long and lengthy draft of a report. There actually was a task force by the state of Massachusetts in 2002, both a majority and a minority report. And one of their recommendations is that they have a 9-member board. And that board was to include only 3 or 4 naturopaths. There was a minority number of naturopaths. And the remainder would be from the other medical professions. Maybe they would have a public member or two. But it was primarily medical professionals. And so it was an extended and expanded board other than what we're talking about here to do everything from pharmacy to control and discipline and so forth. This is essentially a self-regulating board, and it was determined by Massachusetts that naturopaths could not supervise themselves and shouldn't, and they wouldn't even license naturopaths. But this is a growing interest in this country, and they pointed out that there are in the naturopathic profession of these four schools, there's a good deal of support that just comes from the groups that produce the supplementary medicines and so forth, drugs and vitamins that are used in the industry. I do think that there's enough information here that the state could still work with it under the, under the view that you have.
Okay, I guess what I was trying to get at, the choice before us when we consider this bill the next time would be whether we go from one public member to more than one public member.
I think that would be so very important.
Maybe we can consider that, continue that conversation later. Thank you very much for being with us. I guess I'll pose to the committee at this time, is there any other kind of information that we would need to make a decision in the near term on this legislation one way or another. Is there any request for information from the committee? Senator Bundy has asked us to consider the number of public members on this new combined board. We'll sleep on that, think about that for the next time. Yeah. Is there anything else that would help us make a good decision in this committee in what our purview is as the Labor and Commerce Committee? Senator Bundy and then Senator Stevens.
Yeah, thank you. Along the lines of the public members, I'd like to hear from OCC licensing what the usual makeup is. I don't mean to cast aspersions on anyone's ethical behavior, but even on the Legislative Ethics Committee, there are more public members than there are legislators. And the other thing is that I'm really disappointed that report didn't get back, because when this committee addressed this issue previously, I felt there was some inaccurate information about the comparison of training, and that may be why the report never came back. I don't know, but that's unfortunate.
Okay. Did you want us to dig out the work of the 23rd legislature to briefly review that before we make a decision, or just think about that? Let me know.
Well, I'll leave that in your
okay.
view.
Okay. We'll take a look at it. Senator Stevens?
Mr. Chairman, I frankly don't remember how much discussion we had on prescriptions, but and if we've done this, please let me know. But I'd like to know a little bit more about the full ability we're giving them for prescribing drugs. Is it, and I understand there are various levels of drugs, and mm-hmm. does it go to the highest level, or exactly what is the situation?
The powers,
we may have mm-hmm. talked about that. I don't recall.
We did some, mm-hmm. but not fully, and I think it's probably worth reminding ourselves and getting some other resource folks in here. So the whole scope of practice, what are we doing with the scope of practice for this new group to be licensed? And what level of prescriptive power do they have? And I think to feel comfortable that we've done a good job, we need to review some of those details. So at the committee here, we'll roll this bill forward at this time. Senate Bill 107 is officially held for further work by the committee. Committee staff and the sponsor staff and folks from OCC licensing can get their heads together on this, and we will consider this bill again in the near future. Let's turn now quickly to Senate Bill 147, Workers' Comp Employer Liability. Senator French is the prime sponsor of the legislation. He's with us. Welcome, Senator French. This is the first hearing on this bill, so we will take your presentation, any committee comments, and then it's the committee's practice, as you'll remember from last year, to not act on a bill, even if it's in perfect shape and fully supported on the first hearing, but to allow us to fully consider the legislation. So initial presentation today, and then we'll have the bill back before us in a timely fashion. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, and thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I appreciate you making time on your busy schedules for SB 147. The bill is in perfect shape, but I completely understand your policy, and I think it's a good one. The bill makes a tiny change to the workers' comp statutes. And let me just for 60 seconds remind everybody that workers' comp is a bargain. It's a bargain wherein each side gives up something. An employer gives up a premium for a workers' comp policy. A worker gives up the right to go to court and sue for damages that happen in the workplace. Back in the dark ages, when a worker was injured at the workplace, a baker working at a bakery burned in the oven, putting bread in, would have to go to court and sue for the damages of negligence, for example, on the owner's part, to recover for his workplace injuries. Sometimes those produced huge awards, sometimes tiny ones. They were uncertain. Workers' comp is a solution to that. It's a no-fault insurance policy that says if you're hurt at work, you get payment for your injuries. If I may, I'm going to go ahead and read the sponsor statement on SB 147 because it is the first hearing. Workers' comp represents a simple bargain between employers and employees. By purchasing a workers' comp policy, an employer gains immunity from lawsuits that arise out of workplace injuries. This part of the workers' comp bargain is referred to as exclusiveness of remedy, meaning that the employer who buys the policy knows that there won't be expensive and time-consuming court cases arising out of workplace accidents. Injured workers get workers' comp benefits and nothing more. By entering into the bargain, the employee gives up the right to sue for damages. In exchange for giving up the possibility of a large court award, the employee gets relatively swift and fair, though smaller, compensation benefit for his or her injuries. Both sides also agreed to a no-fault provision, meaning there is no inquiry into who is at fault in the events giving rise to the accident. Revisions to the workers' comp statutes in 2004 added a clause to the workers' comp laws that undermine this bargain and work to the detriment of workers injured by third parties who do not purchase workers' comp policies. Under the 2004 changes, employers who are merely potentially liable for buying a workers' comp policy but who do not actually purchase a policy can still get the benefit of the exclusiveness of remedy provisions in workers' comp. This legal imbalance is having real-world consequences, most notably at large work sites where a project owner is supervising many subcontractors. Because the project owner is potentially liable for purchasing workers' comp policies to cover all the work that takes place at the work site, the project owner enjoys immunity from lawsuits that result from its own negligence. Severe injuries take place at some of these large construction projects. When these injuries are caused by the negligence of the owner, the injured worker is left with only workers' comp benefits, which, as the attached letter shows, do not fully cover the damages inflicted by the injury. Removing the phrase potentially liable from the statute restores the bargain to its proper form. If an employer wants immunity, he or she must buy a policy. An employer who gets immunity without buying a policy is getting something for nothing. Basic fairness should not allow such a situation to continue. Please join me in supporting a small change to the law that will result in big changes to the lives of working people. On the easel, to your right, Mr. Chairman, is a very simple stick figure rendering of the letter that you have from Mr. June, illustrating what happened to one of his clients in a real-world situation at Wasilla Elementary. The man in the scissor lift, that's a scissor lift there on an incline, the scissor lift was owned by Collins Construction. They're the general contractor at the work site. They did not purchase a workers' comp policy to cover the worker. The worker worked for Alasco, a subcontractor. When the lift, which was in violation of OSHA laws and hadn't been inspected, hadn't been taken care of, when it fell over and severely injured him, he was left with only workers' comp remedies. If you simply switched those two hats, if you put a Collins Construction hat on him and had the scissor lift owned by Alasco, he could have sued Collins Construction in court for the injury. That's the imbalance created by this statute. That's the asymmetry, the unfairness. It's basically unfair. Collins Construction never paid a penny for workers' comp coverage for that worker. And yet they enjoy immunity from lawsuit from their own wrongdoing. That scissor lift is owned by them, operated by them. That's their responsibility to take care of that scissor lift. They never bought a workers' comp policy to cover the workers that might be on there. But because they're potentially liable, there's another statute, 2330-045, that says when you operate a construction site, you either make certain that sub has insurance or you cover the sub with your own policy. And because you're potentially liable, that means you enjoy immunity from suit. So that's the basic unfairness of the law as it stands today. The law doesn't provide the proper incentives for generals to provide a safe workplace because they're immune from lawsuit from the subs, from the injuries of the subs. And you can imagine other situations where you see severe inequities that arise because of the imbalance. The removing the phrase, the three words, or potentially liable from the statute simply puts the law back in the place where it has been for a century. If you buy a workers' comp policy, you enjoy immunity from suit. You only pay workers' comp remedies. If you don't buy the policy, then you're not covered by a workers' comp. What we've given Collins Construction or any other general contractor is essentially something for nothing. And in my view, that's not fair. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator French. Questions for the sponsor? Senator Stevens?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have enough missing something here, Senator French, but the employee was covered under workers' comp. What did the employee lose by the fact that the company that owned the scissors wasn't? I don't quite understand what the employee lost in that.
He wasn't injured by his employer through the chair. I'm sorry, Senator Stevens.
Right ahead.
He was not injured by his employer. What he lost is the ability to sue, for example, for future loss of income, for pain and suffering, for the wider damages that a lawsuit allow. Workers' comp has fairly strict, as I said, smaller remedies, certain, but smaller, and that was part of the bargain. You give up the right to sue, in exchange you get certain recovery. But that only runs between the people that you know, the person you buy the policy for and the people that are covered.
Senator Bundy?
Thank you. If this law had been in effect then and the general had purchased workers' comp, the injured worker would not have received any more benefits than they currently received.
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, that's exactly correct.
So this bill would have benefited the people who sell workers' comp more than it would have the injured worker. Because I could see the direct, if I might, the result of this is that people are going to buy workers' comp insurance rather than take a chance of being sued by a personal injury attorney.
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, I think that's exactly right, and I would encourage that. But that's you get something for what you pay for. Right?
But it's not going to help the injured worker with more money.
In the cases, in those instances where the general does the responsible thing and pays money for a policy, yes, he or she will enjoy the coverage. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Bundy. Anything further for this? If you can stay with us,
there are legal experts that are here to answer questions, and I'm sure other folks who want to testify about differing points of view.
And for this first hearing on the bill, we have as a resource person, if there are any questions, Mr. Paul Lasanke, Department of Labor and Workforce Development, Workers' Compensation Division. We all know Paul. He is available if something comes up. The first person, Senator Bundy for Paul. Sure. Paul, are you there? He's right back there.
He's hiding
in the back. Didn't see you there at first, Mr. Lasanke. Welcome. If you could just put yourself on the record, please.
For the record, my name is Paul F. Lasanke. I'm the director of the Division of Workers' Compensation within the Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
Senator Bundy.
Chairman, thank you. An unfortunate accident. How often is this the case where we've got a general who's potentially liable but not purchasing workers' comp?
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, I can't really say. I'm not aware of it happening that often, and what I'm somewhat embarrassed to say is when the bill passed in 2004, my understanding is that the intention was that general contractors and project owners would have some type of insurance policy that would pick up as you've heard previously, that would pick up this contingent liability or this potential liability, and I don't really know if that has actually started to happen or not. So I cannot give you a concise answer to your pointed question.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, as you remember, we've had many hours of worker comp discussions. It's a Gordian knot. I'm wondering if Linda Hall would be a resource we'd want to chat with about more flesh out details on who's buying insurance and who's not.
We can do that for the next meeting. Anytime you all think of any material or research that you need for further consideration of this bill, please let us know and we'll add that to the list. Anything further for Mr. Lasanke? Senator Hoffman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you know the reason or the logic why the change was made back in 2004?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I was present at the committee hearings and I tried to take some notes. They're probably not as good as some other people's. So I think the committee members might be able to get someone who's prepared to testify about the precise reasons why the bill was put forward. And clearly, I remember some of the discussion, but I wasn't really the primary mover of that discussion. I'd hate to have someone need to come up and clarify something that I got you off on the wrong foot.
We'll try to pin that down. Anything further for Mr. Lasanke? If not, thank you for being with us, Paul. The first person signed up to testify is Susan Orlansky. There's also Mr. Kevin Clarkson from Tesoro, who's just to answer questions. And then followed by Susan Orlansky will be followed by Kip Knudsen, also of Tesoro. Ms. Orlansky, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Please put yourself on the record, your name and affiliation, and go ahead.
All right, thank you very much. My name is Susan Orlansky, and I am a lawyer with the law firm of Feldman, Orlansky, and Sanders. My firm represents a wide variety of clients in litigation, including at various times both injured employees and companies who were sued for negligence at a job site. So we have clients who see workplace injuries from both perspectives. I heard Senator French's opening comments, and I want to be really brief, but mostly to underscore what he had to say. I tend to agree with his perspective. I think he came up with three very good reasons for this bill. It is a simple fix that fixes a couple of problems that were created by the 2004 amendment that added the words or potentially liable in AS 2330055. I think there are three good reasons to undo what was done a couple of years ago. First, undoing the 2004 amendments that added those words will promote job safety, I think. Right now, general contractors and project owners who are the entities with the greatest oversight over the project and who have the greatest opportunity to establish a safe working environment have really no incentive to be concerned about safety. They are technically potentially liable to pay workers' compensation benefits to any worker on the job site, so the general contractor and project owner are now totally exempt from any risk of tort liability, no matter how unsafe their own practices may be. And in reality, what's unfair about it is they don't ever have to pay workers' compensation benefits to the employees of the subcontractors. The law already requires and has required for many, many years, probably decades, that each subcontractor carry its own workers' compensation insurance for its own employees. And general contractors and project owners on big projects have a way to enforce this, and they do enforce this. They have master subcontracts, which require subcontractors to show a certificate of having purchased workers' comp insurance for their employees before they ever begin any work on the project, which means that the general contractor and project owner have assumed a potential liability, but it's never a realistic liability. And so that leads to the second reason for SB 147. The 2004 amendment added a protection from tort liability for employers who actually don't secure workers' compensation insurance and don't pay workers' compensation benefits. As Senator French said, the 2004 amendments disrupt the basic principle of the Workers' Compensation Act, which is designed as a system where employers and employees each made a trade-off. So the 2004 amendment introduced a new benefit for large employers and project owners and a new disadvantage for employees of subcontractors with no corresponding trade-off. SB 147 would restore the basic workers' comp principle, so that those who pay workers' comp benefits are exempt from tort suits and those who don't pay workers' compensation benefits are not. And third and finally, as Senator French said, the 2004 amendments result in some very illogical and unfair situations where two employees injured in exactly the same way get very different kinds of compensation, and it has nothing to do with who actually pays the workers' compensation benefits. Right now, little subcontracting companies may be liable in tort to employees of larger general subcontractors, but not vice versa. It's not fair, and it's not logical. SB 147 would remedy the unfairness to people like the client described in Mark June's letter. We have a client in a similar situation. He happens to be employed by Tesoro. I think the gentleman is going to testify after me may have a very different perspective on this. But in our perspective, our client was injured at a Tesoro refinery. His own employer paid him workers' compensation benefits. Tesoro didn't do anything for him, but under the 2004 law, Tesoro is exempt from being paid, from having to pay tort damages. SB 147 would remedy those unfairnesses, so we support the bill. If you've got any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them.
Ms. Orlansky, thanks for being with us. Senator Bundy?
I guess if you could help me understand how two employees could get receive different amounts of money. In a Tesoro case, the injured employee is going to be compensated by workers' comp, but if both subcontractor and Tesoro have workers' comp, the employee is not going to get any additional money. So how would two employees similarly situated have different compensation?
Well, if you have, for example, two different subcontractors and one mid-level subcontractor, and it's the employee of the mid-level contractor who acts negligently, the employee of the subcontractor directly under that person is only going to get workers' compensation benefits under the law the way it's set up, but the employee of the other subcontractor who's not a subcontractor under is entitled to sue and recover in tort. And those damages could be many, many times different. Tort damages can be, you know, literally 10 times as high as workers' compensation benefits. Workers' compensation benefits are designed to be sort of minimal, some guaranteed recovery, paid relatively quickly. It's a great system when there's nothing else available, but the common law has also developed a tort system which is more complicated for employees who choose to go that route, but can also end up compensating them much more generously.
Mm-hmm. I understand the tort crapshoot, but okay, thank you.
Anything further for Ms. Orlansky? If not, thank you for being with us. Our next presenter is Kip Knudsen of Tesoro. Mr. Knudsen, are you there? Oh, he's here. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman.
If you could just state your name and affiliation again for the record, and please go ahead.
Yeah, my name is Kip Knudsen. I'm Government Relations Manager for Tesoro Alaska, and thank you very much for allowing me some time today. I'm a little bit nervous. I'm not a lawyer, so I've got one in my pocket, though, in case I get underwater here. So, but I'll keep Mr. Clarkson in the background for the time being, if that's okay. My mind doesn't work all that well, apparently, when I'm reading law, so I had to draw pictures. And Mr. Owens is handing out what I had to draw for a cheat sheet, and you can hand them out willy-nilly as you wish. But this was just for my own ability to understand a lot of the questions you all were just asking. First of all, I'd like to say the current law is good for labor and commerce, and the proposed change probably is a step backwards for both. I also want to emphasize that my company has a core value of safety of workers. You know, we want people to go home in the same condition they arrived, and that'd be contract employees or direct employees. Unfortunately, you know, for me, the most dangerous thing I do is get in my car and drive to a meeting. But the people that are working at refineries and in our distribution system and our marketing retail stores, and they take it very seriously. They work on it every day. It is a constant battle to try to keep employees safe. Some people have said that employers have no motivation to keep their employees safe. I got to tell you, these guys aren't growing on trees. We want to keep them as safe as possible, and we want them to come and go every day in the same condition. We have celebrated some milestones. Our retail sites, for example, just passed the million hours without a day away from work. So we have some successes. Our refinery is recognized among national refiners as a safe operation. And we also hire a lot of contract employees or contractors to work on the refinery and other assets. In fact, when we were building the ultra-low sulfur diesel unit the past year, we had more contract employees at the refinery than we had employee refineries. So this is an everyday circumstance for us. So let me just say there are probably three principles that should underpin your debate on this bill. One, worker safety is a duty that requires a significant resource and effort on everybody's part, the employee's part, the supervisor's part, the employer's part. Number two, all Alaska workers should be covered by a worker comp policy. And third, all businesses benefit from safe employees and reduce legal expenses. So what I'd like to say is the 2004 law change, the current law, has freed up resources and efforts on projects to allow better coordination of safety programs between employers and contractors, with the resulting benefit of hopefully safer workers. Exclusive liability, this benefit that's been talked about, exclusive liability motivates project owners to make sure that everybody that's on the work site, everybody that's on the project site has a workers' comp policy in place. Unfortunately, it does occur from time to time that people will end up on a work site and not be covered by a worker comp policy, all laws aside. And I would like to say to you today that if you don't think that the worker comp benefits are adequate, then set this bill aside and debate worker comp. Let's not debate the exclusive remedy issue. I had to draw some pictures to figure this out because I think the liability law is treating project employees equally. And so if you're working on a school, a hospital, or even a refinery, everybody that's working on that project now under the current law probably is being treated equally. And I had to draw it to make it the case. So chart number one here shows remedies available pre-2004, so before the law was changed. And actually, I'll share this with the sponsor. Sorry. So I put five people that might be on a work site: the owner, project owner, employee, project contractor employee, project subcontractor employee, somebody that's a contract employee but not working on the project, and finally a visitor who just happens to be there. They're all injured simultaneously in the same event, and in this first scenario, we are assuming the project owner is at fault. We have to assume fault to figure out how the remedy then flows. Well, pre-2004, the employee would the remedy for the employee of the project owner would be workers' comp, and then you can see everybody else had both. They could they'll get the benefits through worker comp, which is stated goal I think everybody should be working towards, and then they can also bring a tort claim against the project owner. Okay, if same thing happened today, this is number two. The same thing happened today. They're all injured at the same time at the project site. These are the remedies that would be available to those people if they were all injured at the same time and the project owner was at fault. And you can see they're all available. Worker comp is available to all of them. Now, I might add, if let's say the project subcontractor, for some reason, Tesoro and the project owner and the contractor miss and somehow allow a sub on without a worker comp policy in place, that employee is still allowed to sue the project owner, because if the comp policy is not in place, you do not get that benefit of the exclusive remedy. So for this assumption, though, I'm assuming that everybody had it in place. So everybody gets workers' comp. The only person that can sue in tort is that poor visitor who just happened to be there, checking on supplies or something and got whacked at the same time. Then I did a separate fault scenario, number three. So pre-2004, if the project contractor is at fault, then you can see how things work out here. And I think this is the imbalance that Senator French is discussing, in that in this situation, you can see that if the project contractor's employees, his or her employees are only available, or they can only make use of worker comp, and then everybody else can sue that project contractor. So if you move to today, you see that imbalance where the project contractor and all their subs can avail themselves of worker comp, but the project owner employee could potentially sue down. And the only response I can say to that is that, you know, it is the project owner's responsibility to make sure that everybody has worker comp on the project site. So the reason the remedy flows back to the project owner is because that's the duty of the project owner. Anyway, so I had to draw pictures to make it a little clearer in my mind. And with that, I'll be available for questions.
Questions or comments? Senator Bundy.
Well, and I appreciate the pictures, but I also appreciate fairness. So before the 04 change, then on fairness, you could have workers' comp and place a tort claim in three of the situations where you're working on site. So if we're looking at fairness, it wasn't fair before.
Mr. Knutson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Bundy, Senator French talked about a bargain between the employer and the employee. I quite honestly, I've never understood I ever made a bargain when I took a job. But this is public policy that's been set. The worker comp is a very important public policy. When you change that line, there's always going to be some permutation that may not work out the proper way. The goal, I think, of the 2004 law change is on this slide number two, which is where you have all contractors working on the project treated equally during an injury. There's a no-fault provision. Somebody's injured. They all get the worker comp coverage. And, I mean, I think that was the effort. Pre-2004, a project owner would contract with somebody, and they would have in their contract, they'd have this indemnification clause saying that if somebody's injured and you sue us in tort, you're going to pay the tort liability. So what's happening is a subcontractor comes on willingly. They take the contract. They pay the claims. They pay the worker comp policies. Then, God forbid, somebody gets injured. They get sued, or the project owner gets sued. The contract has the indemnification clause. So what happens is the sub or the contractor ends up paying the worker comp policy, and they end up paying the tort liability just because of the contract situation. So I think those were some of the reasons that this was brought forward. And these are all people all on the same work site, all working on the same project. So
anything further for Mr. Knutson? Senator Bundy.
Yeah, perhaps we need Linda Hall, too, to help me understand. If there's double coverage, and then the project owner and the sub both have workers' comp, now you have double coverage, how's that apportioned out? And it still doesn't get the worker any more money, but does it make the insurance company more money?
We will have Ms. Hall involved in the next discussion of the bill.
Thank you.
And to have her prepped on the issues ahead of time so it can be as productive as possible. Anything further for Mr. Knutson? If not, Kip, thanks for being with us. That's all I had on the sign-up sheet for testimony today. Senator French, did you want to wrap up or rebut, or do you want to save that for the next hearing? And if you speak today, it doesn't mean you forfeit your rights in the future.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I just can't resist.
Which would alarm any attorney, I'm sure.
Mr. Knutson, I thought, gave a fair representation of the state of the law. I'll have to double-check all his subcategories, but I think it's essentially right. But if you look at slide number two and situation number two, the basic unfairness is that the project owner is getting a workers' comp remedy, and he's never paid a penny for a workers' comp policy. And so he has essentially less desire to have a safe workplace. You know, he insulates himself from tort liability because someone else is carrying a policy. If someone gets hurt at his work site that he's in control of, that he or she runs and operates, all they're going to get is workers' comp. And he knows that without ever paying a penny for the workers' comp policy. So it strikes me that that's just simply unfair. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any other questions? Senator Stevens.
Could you, thank you, Mr. Could you answer the question that Senator Bundy asked about how it works with if there are multiple carriers of insurance?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, I think Linda Hall is probably the best person to answer that. My guess would be that a project owner would pay less for workers' comp where every single subcontractor is also carrying a policy, because he or she is only then covering those instances where he or she is at fault. Most accidents are going to happen because a subcontractor makes a mistake, injures himself, and that injury is absorbed by the sub's workers' comp policy. But in egregious examples where the project owner is clearly at fault, imagine if a drunken a drunken truck driver employed by Collins Construction drives over an Alaska employee, right? I mean, just absolutely wild facts. But that contractor is protected from tort liability because of the workers' comp policy that the subcontractors paid for. That's the imbalance. And if the situation were reversed, if the drunken subcontractor runs over a project employee, the project employee is going to sue the pants off of those folks because of the outrageousness of the conduct and the fact that the liability only and the protection only runs downhill. But I think your question, both questions are well posed to someone with more expertise on the nuances of insurance law.
Okay. Thank you, Senator French. We've had the request for Linda Hall to be involved in this discussion as we continue it. Are there any other requests for information that people can think of? Because this is the session where we have to be on top of these things and get any requests. If you all think of anything between now and the next meeting, please give me a call. But we will have Linda Hall available. If there's nothing further on this bill, let's Senate Bill 147 will be held over for further consideration. Senator French, thank you for being with us. I do want to announce that for Thursday, we will meet at 1:30 sharp this Thursday here in the Belt Room. We will have before us Senate Bill 101, Office of Public Advocacy legislation related to guardianship. The bill has come back from the Finance Committee for some further work. Josh Fink will be available to us, and we'll work on that. If Senate Bill 120, the unemployment insurance bill, if we have a committee substitute ready to go, we might have that. We'll let folks know, and bills previously heard. Is there anything further to come before us today? Senator Bundy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've received, and I think they might have been a blanket email to the legislature, a concern from a citizen who's now had their ID stolen twice in the past year. And I know we have an ID theft bill in the committee under bills previously heard. And I think certainly we're getting a time where that ought to be ripe for a hearing. I hope you'll be able to schedule it.
I do expect that subject will come before us at some point. So I appreciate your request.
Thank you.
It's been made in writing as well. Is there anything further to come before us? If not, at 10 minutes to 3 in the afternoon, we are adjourned.